This is the KOTO Community Radio News for Wednesday, April 10th. I'm Julia Caulfield.
And I'm Gavin McGough.
In today's headlines, marshals look for information regarding slashed tires.
Town open space opens new trails.
A ski season wrap-up.
And a mountain weather forecast.
The Telluride Marshals Department is looking for information regarding deputy vehicles that had their tires slashed over the weekend.
We noticed that we have two patrol vehicles that are that were parked in Shandoka, and one of them had all four tires slashed, and the other one had one tire slashed. So completely inoperable.
That's Telluride Chief Marshal Josh Compt. He says the tires were slashed between Sunday night and Monday morning.
The big issue, aside from it being illegal and the vandalism or criminal mischief, you know, it's also, it puts our community members' lives at risk. If, you know, all of our officers are on call, especially the ones that here reside in town. So if we ever had an emergency situation where we need to call them out, they're not going to be able to get to where they need to get to if they come running out to their car and all their tires are flat. So it does put our community members' safety in great jeopardy.
Also, Comp notes, it's a cost to taxpayers.
It's a continued added expense that we have to keep paying for to replace our tires.
The marshals have to keep replacing their tires because this isn't the first incident.
We've had three different cars, patrol vehicles, with their tires slashed all in the Shandoka lot within the past year. Our code enforcement's truck had their tires were slashed while it was parked in front of our station overnight.
Compt says he understands that people get upset when they get a ticket, but adds slashing tires is not the way to settle those emotions.
You know, the response should hopefully overwhelmingly from the community see this and frankly, be frustrated that there's somebody out there, people out there that are targeting our patrol vehicles this way. Because I said, it does put the entire community at risk. We know this is probably the actions by one or a very small number of people and that they don't speak for the, hopefully don't speak for the large majority of the community's opinions about us. You know, and we take it for what that is, but it is, you know, it is frustrating. So obviously somebody out there knows something and, you know, so encouraging them to call or leave an anonymous tip would be very helpful.
Any individual who has information regarding the tire slashing can leave an anonymous tip by calling dispatch at 970-249-9110.
A little snow has never kept folks off local trails. But as winter releases its grip from the Box Canyon, more and more hikers will be heading out for a ramble. If you're among them, you might find some updated offerings along the way.
The trail's part of the work plan. In Bear Creek, we finished the alternate bike route. And what we were doing there was finishing the very top section, which is kind of up by the Suicide Six area or the near where the Wasatch Trail comes onto Bear Creek Trails. And connecting that to the trail about to where the Silver Chief mine was. And so now we have an alternate route for bikes that's west of the current trail all the way down to the kiosk.
That's Telluride Program Director Lance McDonald speaking before town council last week with an update on all things open space. Open space commissioners and staff manage the valley floor, the Bear Creek Preserve, and other town-owned parcels. That new Bear Creek Trail is just one of a number of trail projects completed in the last year, reports McDonald.
We also did a very small bridge with the Pinhead Institute, again, on the west side of the Valley Floor. That's an annual project, and what they do is keep our pedestrian and bike bridges in good shape, and they're awesome to work with, and it's always a good thing for the kids.
Open Space also did significant work reopening and restoring the Cornet Creek Trail, which was closed for much of last year due to danger from rock falls. The trail is now reopened, ready to welcome visitors for the first time in months. Town Manager Scott Robson applauds their effort.
The work on Cornet Creek was exceptional. When you saw what it looked like beforehand after some major rock slides. So really great work out there.
Looking further into 2024, trail work continues with accessibility updates on the river trail along the valley floor. Open space staff also plan to improve the trail situation on the rocky slopes between Town Park and the Bear Creek Road. Says McDonald, that area
definitely deserves some attention. We have several social trails, as you probably know, that are very steep and braided in that area. We have a lot of erosion. So the idea is to provide a bike route that could also be used by hiking to handle the steepest section and to mitigate the damage that's happening there, but also provide both walkers and bikers an easier way up to that the Bear Creek Trail, basically above Firecracker Hill.
Open Space also works with conservation crews on revegetating and monitoring old mining remediation sites. It manages its terrain for invasive species, and it keeps a close eye on forest health. And it partners with area school groups. All of this requires money, of course. Up until last year, 20% of all unencumbered town revenue went into the Open Space Fund, which was used primarily to conserve the valley floor. Then, early last year, town paid off its valley floor debt, and the open space allotment went down to 5%, which amounts to about $1 million for 2024. But the year's projects have budgeted only $6,600,000, leaving a chunk of cash to be banked for the future. Here's McDonald.
So this year would be a gaming year, where we would actually be not expending the full amount that's coming in. The idea is that we bank that those funds for land acquisitions and for larger projects as they come up. So this is a year where we're gaining in the fund, as we should be.
Council members applaud the efforts of Open Space commissioners and staff and pass their work plan for the year ahead unanimously. The wait for the 2024 to 2025 ski season is on. Which is to say, the 23-24 season is wrapped up as of this Sunday. We chatted with some ski patrollers to get their read on the season that was. John Tuckman, who manages snow safety at the Telluride Ski Resort, points to a good year for our local snowpack.
Snowfall-wise, we were above average. We had almost 251 inches between October and March. We were open through the first week of April. We received another 15 inches. Our comparable measuring period for historical purposes is November through March, and that was probably about 20 inches above average. So we didn't bury the needle, but we had a pretty solid season.
About 30 more inches of snow fell during the 22 to 23 season, and the winter of 18 to 19, which is the snowiest in recent memory, saw roughly 100 more inches of snow accumulations. The majority of our snowfall this year arrived in February and March, leaving folks waiting for the mountain to fill out. Ian Kirkwood, who's worked on patrol for 24 years and this season became the director, recalls limited early season terrain, which had patrollers anxious.
It was, it was nail-biting time when we knew we had real big Christmas crowds coming and didn't have a lot of places to put them. We didn't have a good natural snowfall start to the season. And snowmaking did as much as they possibly could. I mean, they were rocking as hard as they could to get things connected and put out there.
Despite concerns over crowded slopes, it worked out in the end. Kirkwood says for the season as a whole,
it was successful in that we had almost the same amount of skier visits as last year, and our injury rates were down, so that's always good.
The other ski safety issue, avalanches. Tuckman remembers the early season as a typical one for the avalanche-prone San Juans.
Pretty much every time it would snow or blow, we were able to trigger large avalanches, often in paths that had produced large avalanches, in the fairly recent past. So I would say that we saw like the expected behavior of the snowpack, which is typically sketchy.
Another pattern that stands out: high temperatures. Storms were interrupted by warm spells, which caused melting and exposed terrain, even high up on the mountain.
Which I feel like contributed to the perception that we had less snow than average. And it certainly felt like we had less snow cover than average, when in fact the precipitation was probably right around average.
But by the final weeks of the season, patchy coverage was a distant memory, as Ski Patrol was able to open the furthest extent of its terrain, including Palmyra Peak, the Gold Hill Chutes, and Gold Hill 2, a tricky line to manage, which some winters never opens at all. Here's Tuckman.
We had a great finish to the season. March was a great month. We had some really outstanding skiing. We had some really manageable avalanche conditions, even in the backcountry. So people over the last few weeks have been able to get out and, you know, ski some big terrain, which I know people really like to do.
And of course, the backcountry remains open. If you're headed out, check the latest avalanche forecasts at avalanche.state.co.us. Resort terrain is currently closed entirely, but it's slated to reopen for uphill ski access on Monday, April 15th.
With the gondola closed, the San Miguel Authority for Regional Transportation, or SMART, is moving to its off-season schedule to keep Mountain Village and Telluride connected. The off-season schedule began on Monday, April 8th, and will run until the gondola's reopening on May 23rd. The schedule offers additional connectivity between Lawson, Telluride, and the village, and adds off-season express routes on weekdays between 6:15 a.m. and 7 p.m. to accommodate commuter traffic. Through April 19th, construction traffic at Meadowlark will close the Meadows and Big Billy stops in Mountain Village. Bus catchers in those neighborhoods should use the Boulder stop. To view a full schedule, visit smarttelluride.com.
Warmer weather means water recreation, and Colorado Parks and Wildlife is urging everyone to stay safe. Colorado's lakes and reservoirs are starting to open up, but cold water can present serious risk. CPW says wearing a life jacket can save lives. According to CPW, wildlife rangers have already responded to multiple incidents this spring involving paddlers falling into the water. One kayaker died and another was hospitalized over the weekend after they fell into the water at Chatfield Reservoir outside of Littleton. Two kayakers were rescued from Ridgeway Reservoir after spending 15 minutes in the water. CPW says in both cases, the water temperature was below 40 degrees and none of the kayakers were wearing life jackets when they went in the water. Officials add cold water temperatures exist year-round in Colorado, and a strong wind gust can knock an individual into the water easily or blow them off course, making it difficult to get to shore. Colorado boating regulations require all adults to carry a life jacket while using a paddleboard, kayak, or larger craft, and all children under 12 are required to wear a life jacket at all times when on the water.
A new bill that would create new protections for Coloradans based on gender identity cleared a major hurdle in the state legislature this week. Under current law, bias-motivated crimes can be connected to a person's race, religion, ancestry, national origin, sexual orientation, or disability. The bill would add gender identity and gender expression to that list. Intimidation and harassment based on those associations would be a misdemeanor. Having cleared the Senate, it now moves over to the House.
A bill trying to limit opioid overdoses and other harm caused by substance use is getting closer to Governor Jared Polis' desk. But as KOTO's Lucas Brady Woods reports, it's been delayed due to concerns over possible ripple effects.
The bill would remove drug-related injuries from doctors' mandatory reporting requirements. It would also allow people to carry drug paraphernalia if they get it from a syringe exchange program or other harm reduction organization. Last week, the Senate added a provision to the bill that would prevent law enforcement from using opioid antagonists like Narcan as the basis for a search. Bill sponsor, Representative Chris DeGry-Kennedy, is concerned the change could do more harm than good.
I think the intention makes a lot of sense, but with all things in criminal law, there are potentially ripple impacts and unintended consequences.
The bill's House sponsors postponed a vote this week to either approve or reject the Senate's amendments. Kennedy says they plan to move forward with the bill after they address any potential implications. I'm Lucas Brady Woods at the State Capitol.
Bob Downs has worked as a physician assistant in the tiny mountain town of Lake City for the past decade. The 66-year-old retired from full-time practice in February. Then in March, he went to Ukraine on a medical mission with Global Care Force, a nonprofit organization. Downs needed to raise $6,500 to go on the trip and surpassed that goal in a matter of days, with a majority of his funding coming from the community of Lake City. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, KVNF's Laura Palmisano spoke with Downs about his experience in war-torn Ukraine.
You retired in February, then in March, you headed to Ukraine. What were you doing in Ukraine?
I was with a group called Global Care Force. They're a group that's been there since the conflict started about 2 years ago, and they are providing mobile clinics to provide primary care for folks that either are displaced or they don't have any electricity or water, that sort of thing. And they'll go in and actually take care of their blood pressure, their diabetes, and all of their medical needs that are primary care needs. And they'll refill their prescriptions for 60 days at a time until they can get back and see them again. In fact, that was one of the reasons I liked this group. There's continuity to what they're doing. They're not just going in one time, taking care of things, and then leaving. They actually are there on a continual basis, trying to get back to the same villages to run a clinic every 60 days.
Where in Ukraine did you go?
Getting to Kyiv was the toughest part. We flew into Krakow, Poland, took an overnight train into Kyiv, and then our first clinic was at a Nazarene church in Kyiv, where there are a lot of refugees. The church is helping those folks resettle there because they've been displaced. And we actually ran an all-day clinic there and saw about 77 patients that day. And then the next day, we went out to two remote villages, the northern suburbs of Kyiv, very near the Belarus border, probably but within 50 kilometers of the Belarus border. We did two clinics, an AM and a PM clinic there. Again, taking care of a lot of their primary care needs. Both of those villages were villages, though, that were occupied by the Russians during the initial push toward Kyiv. In fact, they pointed out a couple of buildings, and a couple of the residents even discussed the fact that they actually were held prisoner in a basement of an apartment building there for about 40 days.
How long did you go? What did you see?
Most of these trips are planned out to be about 14 or 15 days. Again, it takes 3 days to get into the country. It takes 3 days to get out of the country. That leaves you with travel in the country about 7 clinic days, basically. We left the first week in March on around the 4th. I actually arrived in Kyiv around the 7th, and we did our first clinic that day. And then we left the country on the 17th as we made our way back to Kyiv. Some of the clinics were in the far eastern part of the country near Kharkiv. And some of the rural villages we worked in were actually north of Kharkiv, right along the Russian border. In fact, going into the first of those villages, we were within 2 kilometers of the Russian border, although the village itself was actually more like 5 to 7 kilometers away from the Russian border. We actually could hear mortar and artillery fire that day.
You went to Ukraine and it's at war. Why did you do that?
Initially, I don't think we realized we were going to be that close because we were in an area that even our medical director said was considered a gray zone. But when we were doing clinics in that part of the country, we actually were accompanied by a government ambulance, mostly to help us get through checkpoints and that sort of thing, and hoping we wouldn't be fired upon. Although, again, I don't think we're at great risk at that point in time anyway.
When people came to your clinic, what were you treating?
Mostly ongoing chronic illnesses, a lot of diabetes care. We would check their blood glucose, make sure their diabetes medicine was still working, and make sure that we could refill that medication. A lot of hypertension. We would double check their blood pressure, double check the medicines that they were on and adjust them if needed. Otherwise, we would just refill the medicines that they were in need of, those sorts of things. I did get to do one home visit with a diabetic, an amputee. He was homebound, basically, and I got to take care of him. We checked his blood glucose and we made some adjustment on his medication as well.
How many medical providers were in your group and where did they come from?
The American side of our team, the U.S. team, we were basically a group of 6. There were 2 nurses, and then we had 3 providers, a physician who is an internal medicine specialist, and then 2 PAs, and of which I was one of those. And then, of course, we had a behavioral health specialist who was a specialist in post-traumatic stress as well as domestic violence.
What was it like being in Ukraine for you?
I found the Ukrainian people to be extremely friendly. All of the patients we saw in clinic were exceptionally appreciative of the care we were providing. I was very impressed with the resilience of the Ukrainian people too, especially when we were in Kyiv as well as Kharkiv. Life kind of went on. I mean, people were doing the things that they would ordinarily do. They were going to work. They were shopping the way they needed to. Yes, there are a lot of buildings that are boarded up. And yes, they still are under threat of missile attack, that sort of thing. But they seem to be going on with their life. In fact, it struck me as having lived through 9/11, what we felt like maybe the week or two after 9/11, you know, we will not be terrorized. Life goes on. And I sort of felt that way when I was there. And that was the impression I got from both the Ukrainians on our team as well as the folks we encountered in clinic.
The National Weather Service forecast for the Western San Juans calls for clear skies tonight with a low in the mid-20s. Thursday should be sunny during the day and clear at night with a high near 50 degrees and a low around 30. Friday, expect sunny skies with a high in the mid-50s. Friday night should be mostly cloudy with a low around freezing. This has been the news for Wednesday, April 10th. Thanks for listening. If you have a story idea or a news tip, call the news team at 970-728-3206. Kodo News is scaling back for spring break with newscasts on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday during that time. We will start back with our full news programming on April 22nd. And now, a personal commentary.
Hello, this is Yvette Hinson with San Miguel Basin, Colorado State University Extension. We serve San Miguel and West Montrose counties. I'm here to invite you to a class that I'm teaching on season extension. And by season extension, I just mean different methods to add to the time or conditions a specific crop needs to produce a good quality product and good yield. In our short season areas, you can use season extension covers so that you can plant before the average last frost in spring and help plants survive the first frosts in fall to keep producing for a little bit longer. We've been growing and doing trials with season extension covers in our four beds behind the thrift store and the food bank since 2011, and I'm excited to share the information that we've learned. The class is this coming Thursday, April 11th from 6 to 8 p.m. The address is 335 West Colorado Avenue, which is a couple doors east of the thrift store on the corner of Aspen Tree Streets and Colorado Avenue. If you have more questions, just call the office, 327-4393. Thanks, Kodo. Hope to see you guys there.
Opinions broadcast over KOTO are those of the speakers. You are also invited to express your views after the news or on Access each weekday at around 4 p.m. If you'd like to comment, please contact a staff person here at KOTO. We encourage you to speak out on important public issues.